There's that. And then there, but look at all this missed material right here. So maybe.
Okay. Corinne or?
I'll just wait till Annie? Usually a chat note appears. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm convening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Thursday, January 28th. Let's have a roll call, please, for attendance.
Representative Hernandez?
Excused.
Representative Levy?
Here by video.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith?
He will be joining us in a few minutes.
Vice Chair Pham?
Present via video.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson?
Present by video. Thank you. We have several items on our agenda today. Today we start committee business more like usual instead of a committee meeting devoted entirely to an information meeting for a briefing on a big topic. This is going to be more like a typical meeting. We have two public hearings and an informational meeting. I'm going to take the items in the order that they were printed on the agenda. We're starting with a public hearing on House Bill 2458. I'm opening the public hearing on House Bill 2458. LRO, please introduce this for us.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2458 is this year's revisor's bill. And for those who are not familiar with that terminology, this is a bill that is actually put together by legislative counsel for each long session, and it is purely various technical corrections, clarifications, and so forth. And you have with you today from Legislative Counsel, Alan Dale, who will discuss the bill.
Okay.
Thank you. Welcome to the meeting.
Thank you. So, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alan Dale, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. And this is a one-section tax revisers bill. I've never seen one so short. And the only correction it makes is on page 3 in lines 22 and 23. It corrects cross references to ORS 457-445, which was amended and restructured in 2019, and we failed to catch these cross references, and so we had to change them so that the reader is directed to the correct portion of 457-445. I'm sorry, that's it. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. So you really are looking at dotting I's and crossing T's and keeping each number inside of the parenthesis and the semicolons. And are you also watching our work for the Oxford commas?
Well, I don't think we use them. We have to take them out. So yes, we do all that kind of work, and those are all the kinds of housekeeping items that end up in a tax revisor's bill. Non-substantive, purely non-substantive. The correcting the cross references doesn't affect the substance of 457-445 at all.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mr. Alanak, do we have anyone signed up to testify?
You do not, Madam Chair.
Okay. Committee, are there any questions for Mr. Dale? Not seeing any right now. I don't think there's any other anything else to take care of before I close the public hearing, because there is no one signed up for public testimony. So I'm closing the public hearing on this bill. Committee, there is no work session scheduled for this bill yet, but we've heard it, and now it is ready for us to work on if and when we determine that we want to do that. So we're done with that agenda item. We're going to move to the next one. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2456. Mr. Allenack.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton is the economist shepherding this bill, so he has a brief description and some material to go through for the committee before you hear public testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, so House Bill 2456, this is an omnibus bill, and it may be somewhat familiar to some of the returning committee members as well, as this is the language in this bill comes from a bill from 2020. So this is the language in this bill, 2456, comes from Senate Bill 1531A from the 2020 session. So I say that in terms of setting the stage for House Bill 2456, the language is a carbon copy. So it more or less copy and pasted that text from the 2020 version of the bill. So some of the applicability dates and things that are contained in this bill going forward, there could be some need to tweak those as folks may see fit. And another thing, just of a word of note, is, again, this is an omnibus bill. And there could be, in this case, the different component pieces of this bill, there may be individual bills related to that component piece now, or related to that section of statute that are working there or are in the legislature, have been introduced throughout the legislature. So it is a little bit of a different environment, but just so people that are watching this home, and for you all as well, there is a lot of this, it was just copy and pasted in here. So there could be some things, some friction in there, if you will, or for lack of a better term. Just to make people are aware of it, that is something that we were aware of when this was drafted, that it was just a carbon copy there. But so House Bill 2456, and we do have a -1 amendment. I'll get to that. It's an omnibus bill, again, as I said. So I do have in the meeting materials, there's a section contents of all the different provisions that this bill is touching on. I'm happy to step through that and just try to hit the high points briefly of each of these sections, just to give you a sense of what's in the bill, if that sounds good to you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. I'm looking at something like that. Is that the correct document?
That is, yes.
Okay. And it's available on OLIS for members and the public to follow along.
Yes, Madam Chair, it is available on OLIS. I'll see if I can get it pulled up here. There we go. I'm sharing my screen here, so hopefully that shows up for all of you as well. And yes, so it just goes through section by section of the bill, and then I just have a bullet point description of what each section is hitting on, because this does touch even various tax programs as well. But again, so to start off, the first few sections related to property taxes. The first two sections here, really, section 1 to 3, and then 4 and 5, are related to property tax exemptions for low-income rental property, and then also nonprofit low-income rental housing. So there is some similarity, but these are two separate property tax exemption provisions. But so the first change here in the first box, you see section 1 to 3 for the low-income rental property. The first bullet is actually just in some ways using language that's already in the nonprofit low-income rental housing property tax exemption to adjust the requirement of the exemption. So right now there's a requirement of the income of folks that are in this property being related to at or below 80% of area median income. And that's how it aims the exemption towards what's referred to as low-income rental property. So it's really describing some of this language that's in the nonprofit low-income rental housing and placing it into low-income rental property as well. So there's some consistency between those two property tax exemptions. And the key of this language change here is allowing income at or below 80%, which is increased from 60% of the area median income after the first year that a person occupies the property. And the idea behind that is someone may come in initially at income that's below 60% area median income, so they qualify. And then the next year after that, maybe they get a raise or they have a little more income. They're still below that 80%, but they're above the 60%. They would still be allowed to occupy that low-income rental property, and it would still qualify for the property tax exemption. The secondary change that's in both of these provisions is related to more or less updating to some federal changes for the federal low-income housing tax credit and just tying up those so that Oregon's property tax exemption will now align with the federal credit as well, in that some of this property can receive the federal credit and then get this property tax exemption. So that way they're working together, if you will, in the definition. And that's relating again to this definition of area median income, in that it can go up to 80% so long as the property, in terms of like a multi-use property, all of those residents still average out at 60% or less area median income. So you might have one unit that's above it, but then if you have a few below it, it'll average it out in the end. Again, this is aligning with some of the federal changes that took place a few years ago. And I'll try to pause just briefly as for each of these sections, and then I'll just step through it if I don't hear any questions. So moving down to section 6 and 7, this is another property tax exemption related to environmentally sensitive logging equipment. This is an existing exemption that's on the books right now. The change here has to do with a language change of held for use. And the importance here is just there are limits on how this property can be used, or even if there's some cross use. But if a property owner has some property they use this for environmentally sensitive logging, and maybe they go a year where they don't use the property, this change would allow them to continue to receive that exemption, even though maybe they just didn't use it that one year. They didn't then use it for some other purpose. It's just being held there, and they'll use it the following year or something along those lines. But it's just ensuring they don't get disqualified for not actually using the property, but they didn't use it for something non-qualified though. And then moving on to sections 8 and 11, this is another property tax exemption, the single unit housing. The change here is allowing a city to extend a deadline for a completion or construction of the property. This is, again, an existing property tax exemption. This is a discretionary. It's allowing the city to do this. So the city already has the ability to extend the deadline for 12 months because circumstances, maybe the property couldn't get built for certain reasons. They can now do this up to 24 months. So it gives them just an additional 12 months on top of the existing 12 for the city to extend that deadline. The person that's applying for that deadline extension would have to show some cause, and the city would approve that. But again, it's discretionary at the city level. And then there's also some statutory cleanup language in there as well. So there's a bit more moving parts, it looks like, in the legislation, but a lot of that is just correcting some things that were overlapping and such. Moving forward to section 12, that's the property tax deferral program. This is a one-year extension of the deferral program. You, just as a note, I believe you have an informational on this next week scheduled right now. So I'll just move past that one. Sections 13 and 22, this is related to refund interest. This is just an errant on in statute. So this was brought to us by the Department of Revenue, and there was just an on that was kind of put in the wrong, or was included, that would just be taken out of statute. That would allow them, this is only a small change in their refund interest, but it just more or less trues it up with how they treat refund interest for the most part. We do have, there was an example from 2020, I think, from the department that we could make available as well that kind of explains how that moves forward. But again, it's a very, this isn't a wholesale change for the Department of Revenue, it's just a small tweak. Sections 14 and 15 related to the individual development account contributions credit. This is being removed by the Dash 1 amendment, this language, and this was just moving the sunset up. That language has been removed with the Dash 1, and that's reflective of kind of the position of the advocates right now for that program. And there is some other legislation on this as well. This is one of our standard review credits that is coming up for the full review this session as well. So you'll hear more about this later in the session too. Section 16 and 17, this is relating to two auction tax credits, one for the film and video and then the other for the opportunity grant. The upshot on the changes here is really what how this works without going into too much background on these auction tax credits. But the Department of Revenue runs an auction for these tax credits. People bid on them, and then they get to use that tax credit while the state gets the funds from selling the credits at auction. What the change here would do is to try to shorten that time period in some cases for when someone buys a credit at auction and when they can use it on their tax return. So by shortening that time horizon, it can increase, I guess, the value of that tax credit if you don't have to wait as long to actually use it on your tax return to get the benefit of it in some cases. Sections 18 through 21 and grabbing section 23 as well is the Short Line Railroad Credit. This was a credit that was put in place. It was enacted in 2019. The changes here in this measure, they look substantial in some ways because there's a lot of moving parts, but it's really a reorganization of the credit with the underlying intent is not really to change the outcome of the credit, who's going to qualify for the most part or anything along those lines, or even we wouldn't expect it really to have much, if any, revenue impact. But there was just some feedback from how this credit was originally written, so it's trying to rewrite it in a way that I guess fits the desires of some of the folks involved with this one. There's also some corrections to statutory references and such that weren't caught initially when this was enacted. So that's there as well.
And Kyle, I'm going to interrupt here. Representative Marsh has a question, and I'd like to ask the first one. So this one, as you point out, it's relatively new. It's from 2019. You indicate this is reorganizing how this is achieved, but not really a substantive change in direction or policy choices. And one of the issues was that this credit, which would apply on a state tax return, is not, it doesn't come into play if the railroad has received the benefit of federal action or a federal investment, if you will, or a federal incentive. Is that still correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. The limit on this relates to using the credit for the same rehabilitation spending. So if you use those kind of those dollars or that amount that you spent to rehabilitate your railroad or upgrade it, and you receive the federal credit for those same dollars, you can't use those same dollars to then or those same expenses to then claim Oregon's credit. Now, there could be potential where a railroad could use different ones. Maybe they do different parts of the railroad, and they could benefit from both at the same time, but you wouldn't use the exact same, you know, rehabilitation project you did to qualify for both the federal and Oregon's.
Thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. And along that same line, because I think Chair Nathanson and I have been in the same hearings on this subject, I thought I read recently that this credit had been reinstated or refunded at the federal level. Has there been a change in that? Because we're motivated to take this on because it had been suspended or temporarily eliminated.
Yes, Representative Marsh, they did recently in the Consolidated Appropriations Act. So just at the very end of December, at the federal level, they extended the credit. I believe there was a modification that I can't recall what that was, but they also, I believe, removed the sunset on it at the federal level. So there was a, I will get back to you on what the tweak was, but yes, I did see that was included as well, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. So I think that covers the short line in general. There was a, the other changes were changing the biennial cap from being a biennial cap to an annual cap and then just cut it in half. So functionally it worked the same, but that's a little more helpful in how to fit these projects if we are getting near the cap in the credit. And then there was some change in how to modify the prioritization of the credit. And the change now here for the priority would really be ensuring that those publicly owned short line railroads are first in line to receive the benefit of this credit. And then how that, if we do exceed the credit cap, the new $2 million annual cap, how that would be ratcheted down. That language has been, that is included in there as well. But again, it's putting those publicly owned rail lines first.
Representative Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kyle, I just had a question about the definition of environmentally sensitive logging equipment. Is it true? I think I just read somewhere in the ORS that, of course, logging equipment means any kind of, you know, well, I think it's pretty self-explanatory, but the environmentally sensitive part is any logging equipment that was originally manufactured after 1992. What was the reasoning behind that? I mean, I can see how maybe in 1996 it might have been considered environmentally sensitive, but I'm interested in, are there updates to what we consider environmentally sensitive? Because if it's 30 years old now, I'm not sure if it would still qualify as environmentally sensitive. Can you give me some insight into that?
Yeah, Representative Pham, that is true. That's the definition that is used. So it's still the definition that is in place for the exemption. I know Jamie McGovern's in the meeting as well, who handles property tax for legislative revenue. So I don't know if there, I'm not aware of the conversations, if there have been any ongoing of whether or not that date needs to be moved up, or if there was some change of significance in that 1992 that really was what they were pointing at, and they just used the date. But I think if I understand your question, it's more trying to understand, what caused that change, and is it still relevant in the same context as it was when this was put in place?
Thank you. Thanks for that.
Okay, so then moving past the Shortland Railroad credit, Section 22 is just effective dates. Moving on to Section 24, this touches on the corporate excise tax, and this is updating an Internal Revenue Code cross-reference. So there was a change at the federal level, and we're just now picking that up where they changed their statute numbering. But again, it's just a cross-reference change here. Section 25 relates to the special use fuel license fee. And this is just requiring the Department of Transportation and the Transportation Commission to review on a biannual review process the special use fuel license fees and recommend to the Transportation Committees of any adjustment that's needed. And again, this is relating to, the example would be a vehicle that's powered by propane. And so instead of paying a gas tax on this, they have an annual fee that they pay in lieu of that gas tax for the propane. So this just requires kind of an annual or a biannual review of whether or not that in lieu of payment does kind of true up with what they'd be paying on the fuel side of things if they were subject to that tax. Section 26 is a vehicle privilege tax, and this is just allowing Department of Revenue to share information with DMV about this. So it's, it does require a law change to allow Department of Revenue to share this information to allow them in administering the tax in some cases. And sections 27 through 29, background, this is City of Portland and background checks. I know we have testimony or people signed up to testify on this one from the City of Portland, but it has to do with their municipal tax collection. And they're receiving a federal tax information and some of the requirements there. So they're asking for a law change here to allow them to do these criminal background checks. And then finally, we have the Department of Revenue report. This is a report related to global intangible low taxed income, acronym GILTI, that the committee has heard about in the recent days. And there is a requirement under current law of DOR to prepare a report that was due this past December, related to GILTI. Now, of course, the timing of returns when this information comes in is actually going to be later than when this report was due. So it's moving that report deadline out by a couple of years for the Department of Revenue, so they'll actually have the ability to sift through the return data and better and more fully answer or respond to the questions the legislature put forth in requiring this report. But again, that's the section by section. We do have that dash one amendment, which is just removing that the IDA provision.
Thank you. As Mr. Easton pointed out, this bill is just a copy of a previous bill that had already been prepared, already been worked out, and it just didn't it didn't make it over the finish line in a previous session. So it was just simply copied and brought forward for us. Between then and now, the world has changed. And in particular, for a couple of the interested parties, stakeholder groups, if you will, who are most closely connected with a particular thing. You heard about one, the Individual Development Account, or IDA. Another one would be the film credit. So I expect, committee, that by the time we work this bill, it will look different than what you see printed in front of you right now. It's a perfectly normal thing. I'm not concerned at all, and I anticipate we will hear some public testimony about this. So I have already opened the public hearing on House Bill 2456. I had a list on a witness registration that I received earlier before 1 o'clock. Mr. Allen, yes.
You might want to stand at ease. We're having technical problems. I understand that you have up to 6 people signed up, and they may all be in a waiting room, but we can't access them from here. We've reached out to IT, and we're trying to resolve the problem.
Okay. Then let me ask one more question before we stand at ease. Were there any additional people signed up after the preliminary list that I received? I think you said there are 6 waiting, but that could be, they could be waiting for the informational meeting later also.
These are 6 people who have signed up for House Bill 2456, and we had no additional signups.
Okay, got it. Thank you. We will be at ease now. So that should mean that we're not broadcasting live.
In the recording.
And I plan to call on Mr. Dale first if he is ready.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm ready.
Thank you.
So again, for the record,
we're not.
You are recording now.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. We're no longer standing at ease. The technical issues have been addressed. Now, when we were getting ready for taking public testimony, there was one other piece of business. Mr. Dale, could you please talk to the committee?
Sure. Again, for the record, my name is Alan Dale. I'm Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. And I just raised my hand to say that I have some insight into the 1992 date for the definition of environmentally sensitive logging equipment for Rep. Pham. And so I can, if you want me to say it to the committee, fine. Otherwise, I could send it in an email to Representative Pham.
I would like to hear it if it's just a couple of minutes.
Sure. So what I'm looking at is excerpts from the legislative history of the bill that became 307-515. The witness was the executive vice president of the Associated Oregon Loggers, who said that he was working with the governor and on the bill, looking at different ways to define the equipment, talking about specific pieces of equipment that was designed to be lighter on the land. And it became so complex that the governor's office agreed that the age criteria was probably the best, with the theory being that newer equipment has been upgraded to meet those environmental conditions. And then he further said that working with the governor's office and AOC, they chose the date because logging equipment that is less than 8 years old, I'm sorry, and this is in 1999, logging equipment that is less than 8 years old, based on their experience, is that it's environmentally sensitive by virtue of its design and use. And that's it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's helpful. Okay, we are ready to proceed now with the public testimony. The first two people I'd like to hear from are John Van Landingham and Allison McIntosh. Immediately after that will be Eric Knoll and Dory Van Bockel. So first, Van Landingham and McIntosh.
And they may need to press.
I just did star six, so yep. I hope you can hear me. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. This is John Van Landingham. Sorry for all the technical difficulties. I'm a lawyer with Oregon Law Center, Lane County Legal Aid in Eugene. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 2456, specifically sections 1 through 5. Chris already reviewed for you, or Kyle reviewed for you, what's in sections 1 through 5. They amend two existing property tax exemptions for affordable housing. They're both local option, 307.515 and 307.540. Different cities have adopted one of them. Eugene, for example, has adopted 307.515. There are two significant amendments here. They have nothing to do with the sunset. Allison McIntosh is going to talk about the income averaging one. I'm going to talk about the income increase one. Note for you, the property tax exemptions are a big deal to affordable housing projects. They allow the project to get built and then to keep the rents low. It's an operating expense that they can not pay and lower the rent. The amendment that I'm addressing allows a local government, doesn't require, allows a local government to treat as eligible a property where the resident's income increases above the typical standard 60% of median income or below. It, after the first year, would allow the resident's income to increase to 40 to 80% of AMI. The concept here is that we want occupants, tenants to be able to improve their situations and hopefully someday move towards home ownership. You're not going to be able to qualify for a home loan on 60% of AMI, but you might at 80. And so we, rather than throw people out and prevent their ability to improve themselves, we want to encourage that. Again, it's a local option. A local government would not need to do that. Typically for a property, not typically, but for one of these exemptions to apply, it has to be adopted by typically the city and the school district to get to more than 50% of the tax rate, and then that leads to 100% exemption. This change, the one I'm describing, was already adopted in 2015 for 307.540. Here we're adding it to 307.515 to make the two the same. So as I said, some cities use 307.515, some use 307.540. This concept, as Kyle noted, was in Senate Bill 1531 in the 2020 session. It passed the Senate 29-0. It passed your committee 4-0 before the quorum problem developed. So we urge your support. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. McIntosh?
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Rusky, Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today to, on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance, to express our support for the provisions related to affordable housing and homeownership in House Bill 2456, and to note a change in the sections related to the Oregon Individual Development Account Initiative. The Housing Alliance is a coalition of more than 90 organizations from all parts of the state, which include housing developers, residents of affordable housing, local jurisdictions, and organizations working to meet basic needs in every corner of our state. We believe that all Oregonians need a safe, stable, and affordable place to call home. And across Oregon, we simply don't have enough affordable and available homes for every household that needs one. I wanted to start with sections 1 through 5, which, as John noted, impact two local option affordable housing property tax exemptions. Over the years, the legislature has authorized several of these exemptions, and they are one tool local jurisdictions can use to help incentivize and make financially viable affordable housing developments in their communities. organizations across Oregon, affordable housing developers and public housing authorities have been building safe, stable, and affordable homes for many decades. These rental homes receive public funds and in exchange follow strict rules about the income of people who qualify for the housing, how much rent can be charged, and how long the homes remain affordable. We have several local, state, and federal tools to help pay for the development of these apartment homes, although the need for the homes is far greater than the currently available resources. Property tax exemptions are one tool to incentivize and make financially viable affordable housing developments across our state. With regards to this change, in 2017, the federal government made a critical change that will allow for people of different income levels to be served by affordable housing. The policy that was adopted by the federal government impacted the federal low-income housing tax credit, which is one of our main tools to develop affordable housing. This tax credit program was designed to serve households earning at or below 60% of the area median income. This policy change, which is called income averaging, allows a development to serve people with slightly higher incomes, up to 80% of area median income, if the property also serves folks with lower incomes, and the average of the incomes in the property remains at that 60% of AMI. Income averaging was created to serve folks with slightly higher incomes, and particularly in rural areas, those folks have increasingly not been served by the market. So folks earning 80% of AMI make too much to qualify for affordable housing, but don't make enough to afford market rate housing. And then the policy was also adopted to help the program better serve folks who earn incomes lower than 60% of AMI. And the change is really critical. We need the most affordable homes for people with the very lowest incomes in our community. For folks who are living on Social Security, people experiencing homelessness, and a developer who chose to use this flexibility would be required to serve people with lower incomes in order to meet the rules under the program. Oregon Housing and Community Services, which regulates affordable housing providers and the low-income housing tax credit program, has begun implementing this new policy, and we need our local option property tax exemptions to align with these new criteria and flexibility. The first project using this income averaging tool is currently under development in the city of Gresham. The language included in this bill would raise income limits served by these exemptions to align with the new federal definitions if and only if the program is using this new federal program. The change would also allow local jurisdictions to have choice and flexibility about whether to allow this new policy in their community. Next, before I wrap up, I just wanted to very briefly express our support for Section 6 through 10 of the bill, which impacts the home ownership limited tax exemption technical fix. I know folks from the City of Portland will share more detail, and I went into more detail in my written testimony as well. And then lastly, I just wanted to reference the changes to the Oregon Individual Development Account Initiative and the -1 amendments to remove Sections 14 and 15 from the bill. The IDA initiative is a match savings program that supports folks with low incomes to buy a home, make an investment in their education, start a business, or reach another goal. And advocates are seeking to renew the tax credit for the IDA initiative, and you will be hearing lots about House Bill 2551 at a future date. So we really appreciate committee staff for drafting the -1 amendments and appreciate the committee's time today and urge your support for House Bill 2456. Thank you so much.
I'd like to clarify something with you briefly. You expressed support for extending the sunset and for the IDA. So someone might be confused, well, then why did you want amendment to take it out? It's because there is some other type of work that you would like to propose. And for that to happen, it will come through another bill, not through a technical change bill like this one. Good. Otherwise, someone might have scratched their head and said, well, why didn't you just leave it in there? It's because there are some other changes that will be proposed for consideration to achieve the same objectives. Good. Thank you. Committee, do you have questions for these two witnesses, Van Lanningham or McIntosh? I don't see any questions coming up. Thank you both. I will now call on Eric Knoll and Dory Van Bockel.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Excellent. So good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Reschke and Pham, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll with the City of Portland. Thank you for taking the time to hear our testimony today, and thank you to staff for helping us get on the line. I'm here to speak briefly in support of two components of House Bill 2456. Both items are narrowly tailored and will only apply to the City of Portland. As you've heard, the language in House Bill 2456 is identical to Senate Bill 1531A from the 2020 session. My goal this afternoon is simply to reestablish the legislative record on these two items. First, sections 8 through 11 include a technical fix to the Homebuyer Opportunity Limited Tax Exemption, or HOLTE for short. The HOLTE is a local option property tax exemption supporting homeownership for low and moderate income families. Portland is the only jurisdiction at this time that is implementing the HOLTE. And the City of Portland is seeking a narrow expansion of the statute to allow the city to extend construction period eligibility on projects for up to 24 months on a case-by-case basis if progress is being made with construction. I'm joined by Dory Van Bockel from the Portland Housing Bureau, who will speak more to this program in just a moment. The second, sections 27 through 29 include an authorization for the City of Portland Revenue Division to request federal background checks of their employees from the Oregon State Police. The City's Revenue Division, like other tax collection agencies, uses federal tax filer information from the Internal Revenue Service to confirm compliance with our tax codes. The IRS has numerous requirements governing the use and protection of FTI. One requirement was strengthened in 2016, and that's the addition of background investigation minimum requirements for tax agency staff who have access to FTI. Specifically, these staff background checks are required to include a federal fingerprint check. The FBI has informed the city through the Oregon State Police and the Portland Police Bureau that they will conduct checks only for those agencies with state-level legislative authority. And we do not currently have that authority. You'll see written testimony on the record from our Revenue Division Director that includes a copy of the letter we received in May of 2019 from OSP. Prior to bringing legislation last session, city staff exhausted every internal and administrative possibility over the course of multiple years. A statute change is the only option that remains for us to comply with IRS guidelines, and we worked with OSP to develop the language in this bill. House Bill 2456 and sections 27 through 29 will do three things. First, it'll narrowly adjust the definition of authorized agency in ORS 181A.195 to allow for necessary access for municipal tax collection agency in a city with a population of 250,000 or more. The City of Portland is the only city above this threshold, so think this will only apply to the Revenue Division staff at the City of Portland. And it will also establish the Municipal Tax Collection Agency's authority to request federal background checks through OSP. And importantly, it will direct a written agreement with OSP that will specify the scope of work for the background checks and provide for the reimbursement of costs. It's our intent to reimburse Oregon State Police completely for conducting these background checks. The IRS Office of Safeguards has indicated that agencies remaining out of compliance at their next on-site review may receive a critical finding, resulting in a loss of access to FTI data. The Revenue Division's next review is scheduled for August of 2021. The city has also transitioned to a new integrated tax software system last September that will be compliant with IRS requirements for access to FTI. Absent these background checks and loss of FTI, the city will stand to lose the ability to collect an estimated $12 to $13 million in additional revenue for more efficient collections. Thank you for this time. Thank you for your time this afternoon, and I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Ms. Van Bockel. It looks like that phone is still muted. I'm comparing the phone number.
You can press star six to unmute on the phone.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson.
Please go ahead.
Yes,
yes, please go ahead. State your name.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Reschke and Pham, and members of the committee. My name is Dory Van Bockel. I'm Program Manager for the Housing Bureau at the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Sections 8 through 11 of House Bill 2456. As Eric described, the Homebuyer Opportunity Limited Tax Exemption, or HOLTI program, is an affordable ownership tool to stimulate the construction of new single-unit housing and encourage homeownership amongst low and moderate-income families. In Portland, the HOLTI allows the city to forego property tax revenues in order to incentivize opportunities for homeownership. The City of Portland is seeking a technical fix to HOLTI to allow the city to grant an extension to the construction timeframe for newly constructed single-unit housing up to 24 months, 1 year at a time, if an applicant documents progress with construction. Currently, homes must be fully constructed upon sale and sold within 2 years of final permit or certificate of occupancy. This timeframe has unintended consequences for home builders, particularly such as nonprofits such as Habitat for Humanity, that often request a group of building permits for development be processed together rather than individually. Home builders must apply for HOLTI prior to building permit issuance. This can put homes at risk of not being built within the two-year construction timeframe, and as a result in the last year, 12 homes lost their tax exemptions in September due to the two-year timeframe, and others are at risk. The benefit of the 10-year property tax exemption to low-income home buyers is an exemption of the structural improvements of their home as long as that home remains owner-occupied and owners are still responsible for payment of any taxes on the assessed value of the land throughout the exemption. This program incentivizes the development of family-sized housing and requires that they be two- or three-bedroom units, and it has income limitation within the City of Portland as well based on that family size of a two- to three-bedroom home, currently at 100% of median family income, which is $92,100. However, the actual use of the program saw incomes from home buyers averaging at around $54,000 or less than 80% of median family income. The program also operates with a sale price cap for home purchases. We review that annually based on statutory requirements. It cannot exceed 120% of the median sale price. 2020 county records show the median sale price for Portland to be around $428,000. And with that, the current price cap for 2021 is $412,000. Average sales of homes was actually around $328,000 within the program last year. The benefit of the exemption will vary on an individual property, but averages out to about $2,700 per year. So it's a huge impact on the monthly affordability of a payment. The program's cyclical. Obviously, as to who utilizes it, we do have a cap limit on the program. We saw roughly 175 new applications in the last year, with over 105 homes sold in that time frame. We've been able to assist over the life of the program over 6,000 low-income first-time homebuyer households achieve their dream of homeownership. When the tax exemption expires, properties will be fully assessed and homeowners begin paying the full taxes. The Bureau supports homebuyers in preparing for this event by sending letters starting 2 years prior to the exemption expiration to make sure they're aware of and advising them to start saving for higher taxes. When resale occurs within the 10-year timeframe, we verify subsequent homebuyers' income and the household must income qualify. We also monitor to ensure owner occupancy and remove any exemptions that are found non-compliant.
This request is a small change for big impact for dozens of new low-income first-time homebuyers, and we urge your support. Thank you very much for your time today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, both of you. Committee, do you have questions for either of these witnesses, Noel and Van Bockel? All right, thank you both for being with us. I am calling next on Kevin Campbell. Mr. Campbell, are you available with us now? And if you are muted, it will have to be.
And members of the committee.
Good.
Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Fantastic. So for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated Oregon Loggers to support House Bill 2456 and to specifically speak to Section 6 that clarifies the applicability of the personal property tax exemption to logging equipment that is not in use during a tax year. As quick context, there are over 900 mainly small and family-owned businesses that do forest management work in Oregon. And the equipment they own and as these small businesses is very expensive. It's like a large mortgage. So I've had the privilege of working on behalf of the Associated Oregon Loggers to pass the personal property tax exemption for logging equipment from the time it was first introduced over 20 years ago. In 1999, the Oregon Legislative Assembly passed and the governor signed House Bill 2045. It was a measure that created an exemption from personal property tax for environmentally sensitive logging equipment, which Mr. Dale discussed in his introduction. The purpose of the exemption was to incent the purchase of newer equipment designed to reduce the environmental impact of logging practices on our working forests, and to also recognize the impact of taxation on equipment that can sit idle when the market contracts and opportunities to work are reduced, especially with the expense of the equipment. So this statutory change clarifies the meaning of the word used in ORS 307-827. It's the word used can be interpreted a couple different ways. It can be interpreted to mean that the equipment must actually be used during the tax year in order to qualify for the exemption, or it can be interpreted to be mean that it refers to the purpose of the equipment. So Section 6 is designed to change it to make sure that it's clear that it's for the purpose of the equipment. So it changes the wording in ORS 307.827 from used to used or held for use in order to honor the original intent of the exemption and to provide clarity to the Department of Revenue as they advise county assessors regarding implementation of the exemption moving forward. It makes little sense to require a logging company to pay personal property tax on equipment that is idle during the tax year because it can't be used and exempt this very same type of equipment from the tax when it is in use. So with that, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, thank you for your consideration and your time today. Thank you for letting me testify, and I'm glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Committee, are there any questions for Mr. Campbell? I don't see any. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and committee members.
Committee, we have available, in case you have questions on other parts of the bill that haven't been covered in the witnesses already, if you have anything that you would wonder about from the film and video office, we have someone available, Mr. Williams, and also someone from Department of Revenue, if there was any section of the bill where you wanted to ask something else. So before we conclude this public hearing, do you have any questions for either of those people? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I was, I don't have a question for them, but I do have a question for Chris, kind of on the history of this again. So this was run in 2020. It was Senate Bill 1531, passed the Senate 19-0, I think, came to the House, and I don't think we were here to, the Republicans were here to hear it or to do the work session. And so that's why I'm kind of trying to say, look at my notes and figure out, have I heard this before? And the answer is, I don't think so. So I'm just trying to make sure that's accurate history.
Yes, that's generally accurate. It did come over to the House Revenue Committee. I can't remember. I'd have to look up the attendance for the meeting.
Yeah. It was on the 26th, and I don't think I was in Salem on that day. So, okay, I have no further questions at this time. Just wanted to kind of make sure I was correct on that history.
Sure, and that's why we wanted to make sure that we had a very full, plenty of time available for a public hearing, and also to make sure that any agency people, legislative council, were here so that we could just hear it from the beginning.
Thank you.
Anything else? Mr. Alanak, is there anything else you think we need to do before I close this public hearing on House Bill 2456?
I think that's it.
Okay.
I'm not seeing any other questions, and you've gone through the witness list, so I think so.
Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2456. Thank you, everyone who's been in the lobby, in the waiting rooms, waiting on the phone. We're done with those two bills now. We are now moving to an informational meeting. I'm opening the informational meeting on property tax response to wildfires. You will hear, committee, some reference to a bill. This is not a public hearing on a bill. A long time ago, in September, I asked the question of several people and made the suggestion that all committees ought to be thinking about what we could do to help Oregonians weather the pandemic and then weather the devastation from the wildfires. Most of the work was being done by other committees. There were joint committees on dealing with the pandemic, joint committees dealing on the wildfire, how people working in housing policy committees were hearing a lot, people working on healthcare committees were hearing a lot, but I felt pretty strongly that every committee ought to be thinking about, is there anything in our bailiwick that we can do to help? So one of the outcomes of that is Representative Marsh has been working on the issue of property tax from people who have gone through terrible loss, and you have this loss, and then a month later, you get your bill for property taxes, and it just seems almost unbearable what it must feel like. So I have asked Representative Marsh to put together a panel to talk to us about what this situation has meant for Oregonians and why, you know, what would be within our area that we could do to help. So Representative Marsh is available. Mr. Alanak, is there anything you would like to do to present this topic for us first?
I don't think so, Madam Chair. I think you did a nice job of that and handing it over to Representative Marsh.
Okay.
Thank you, Rep. Marsh. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Pam Marsh. I'm the representative from District 5, which is Southern Jackson County. In brief, the bill that we are here to talk about today, House Bill 2341, proposes changes in current property tax law that will provide more equitable relief to taxpayers whose homes are damaged or destroyed, either in a widespread disaster, including wildfire or flood, certainly like we saw in September, or as a result of a single act of God. Before we dive into the details at issue here, however, I'd like to briefly describe the process that resulted in this proposed legislation.
And I'm going to interrupt one more time just to emphasize this is not a hearing on a bill at this point. Rep. Marsh is presenting us the concepts that are covered so that we understand all the important issues that had to be worked out in trying to figure out taxpayers, the plight of the taxpayers that had just been through this. But this is not a public hearing on a bill. The bill is actually in another committee right now. If that committee passes the bill out favorably, then we will have it to consider eventually.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification, Chair. As Rep. Nathanson described, and as we all know way too well, the wildfires that coursed the Oregon landscape in early September 2020 caused horrific damage across the state. When the flames subsided, we realized that approximately 4,000 homes had been destroyed. 2,500 of those were in the little towns of Talent and Phoenix, which sit in the heart of my legislative district. In the weeks that followed, I started reaching out to experts across the state to understand what kind of relief we might be able to provide to those homeowners. And in that process, reaching out, talking to people, I learned that the Oregon State Association of County Assessors had identified problems in the current property tax system that would result in significant inequities for some of the affected homeowners. I met with the assessors, and then we pulled together a work group to examine the issue and vet the proposal that the assessors had put together. So the bill that we are just describing today, House Bill 2341, is the result of that discussion. And that discussion includes the League of Cities, the Association of Counties, the Home Builders Association, the Department of Revenue, the Legislative Revenue Office, the assessors, the county tax collectors, and several legislators, including myself, Representative Gomberg, and Senator Finley. So as a result of this discussion, we put together draft legislation that has three aims. First, we realized that we needed to make changes to the proration formula that is used to recalculate a homeowner's property tax bill after a home is destroyed to provide better equity to all homeowners. Second, we wanted to adjust the timeline and the process for providing bill adjustments in cases where a home has been damaged but not destroyed. And third, in cases, as we had in September, where an emergency or conflagration has been declared, we wanted to empower the assessors to proceed with proration and bill adjustment without waiting for the homeowner to file a request. We know that homeowners in this situation have been traumatized. They have a million responsibilities in front of them, including just providing for themselves and their families. And so the assessors volunteered as part of this conversation that they could proceed with making adjustments to the bill when the evidence of destruction is so obvious. So with that brief description of the conversations that we've been having, I'm going to call upon Joe Davidson from Lincoln County, who serves as legislative co-chair for the State Association of County Assessors, and he can provide a little bit more detail on our discussion and the proposal that we put together. But before I do that, I do want to call out the assessors who identified this problem, who proactively proposed a solution, and then diligently worked with stakeholders to try to put together a proposal. I think there's a strong argument to be made that the proposal actually puts more responsibility on the assessors, and thus I think it's particularly, I'm particularly grateful to them for really taking this on and aggressively looking for a solution. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I think Joe, Mr. Davidson should be in the lobby somewhere ready to talk about some details of our proposal.
Great.
Yes, this is Joe Davidson. Thank you, Representative Marsh, Chair Nathanson, and members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
Can hear you fine, and we see you too. That's great.
Okay, great. Yes, and thank you to Representative Marsh for organizing that committee. We really appreciate bringing attention to this issue that we're presenting today. I just wanted to start by, again, I'm Joe Davidson, Lincoln County Assessor and Legislative Co-Chair for the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. And I'm coming here today from more of an administrative standpoint behind this concept, as I am also operating in a county that was impacted by the 2020 wildfires, mainly to focus on, you know, we have isolated fire events in the county each year that we have to address and adjust for, but the wildfires that happened in September of 2020 were unprecedented pertaining to residential improvement losses. And we really recognize some of the administrative hurdles under current statute 308-425, both for administrators and also some inconsistencies across those who are seeking relief. And so that's what we're really trying to address. And Representative Marsh did point out the three issues at hand. I just wanted to kind of explain those in further detail and then provide some recommended considerations for the committee to act as potential solutions. And we did provide a one pager. I'm hoping everybody has that or has had a chance to review that. Did you all get a copy of that?
It is in the meeting materials, and Haley is ready to pull it up on the screen so that everybody can see it, if it would help to scroll through it if you'd like.
Sure, that'd be great. Thank you. So this is kind of our one pager from our associations that we've put together, just to briefly summarize the issues at hand. We start with kind of the statement that I already described, that this is unprecedented damage that we're focusing on here and trying to provide solutions for. So I'm just going to go down the line explaining the issues, starting with number one. Under current law, 308-425, there must be a loss in assessed value in order for anyone to receive property tax relief. And as you know, every property has really two values that we look at to determine the assessed value. So you've got the real market value of the property, which we as assessors adjust each year based on market conditions, and the maximum assessed value, which has been in place since Measure 50 in 1997. Real market value can fluctuate. Maximum assessed, as long as there's no exception events involved, grows typically 3% each year. So there's really no relationship between the two. And because of that, the gap between those two values can vary greatly from property to property. And in order for someone to receive relief, there must be a loss in assessed value. Now, assessed value is the lower of those two values. And so there are situations where a property owner may lose their home or have damage to their home, but it doesn't drop the real market value down far enough to impact the assessed value of the property. Basically, if the real market value stays above that maximum assessed, even after the damage is accounted for, they may see no property tax relief. So that's kind of the first issue. And I can tell you firsthand that it's really difficult when somebody calls in who just lost their home due to a wildfire, that they're not going to receive any property tax relief this year. Whereas their neighbor who lost their home may see a significant refund. So there is that inconsistency, and that's really the first and foremost issue we wanted to point out. Number two, there are, can you scroll down as I kind of talk through this, maybe? That would help. Number two is that they're under the same statute. There's different procedures that exist depending on whether the property is only partially damaged or completely destroyed. Now, basically, just to backtrack a little bit, the procedure involved for prorating or adjusting the property taxes, we break the tax bill up into twelfths to to represent the 12 months of the tax year. And the months that aren't affected by the damage are taxed at full amount. The months that are affected are then adjusted based on that loss in value. And so under current law, if the property is only partially damaged, that proration begins the month of damage. If the property is completely destroyed, the proration begins the month following damage. I'm not really sure why that separation exists, but that is something we want to address because that is somewhat of an inconsistency. Also, if the property is only partially damaged, we have to wait as assessors and tax collectors, we need to wait to ensure that that property has not been repaired at any point during the tax year following. So that creates even more consistency. We're trying to process these and provide refunds to these affected victims. If it's only partially damaged, we need to hold off on providing any sort of refund or revised tax statement to ensure that the property wasn't repaired. Whereas if it's destroyed, we can go ahead and process it, send out a refund or revised statement. And when we're, you know, I, for example, am sitting on about 400 of these properties that we've identified from the beginning that were affected by the wildfires, yet depending on the situation, we may need to hold off on some of those. So that's issue number two. And number three is also under the same statute, 308.425, we have to have authorization as we, meaning the tax collectors and assessors, need to have authorization from the individual homeowner through an application, a signed application, before we can actually provide them tax relief. Now, it's understandable in isolated incidences because there are restrictions also in these applications that there must be a fire report provided to ensure that there was not arson involved by the property owner. But in the case of wildfire, it's recommended that this form may not be necessary. So those are the three issues. And then if we go down a little bit further, these are kind of the basic solutions to those. Number one, going back to the issue of value loss relating to relief. Currently, there must be a loss in AV. We recommend that any loss in RMV, real market value of the property, should be the percentage used in providing relief. That should be what the percentage is tied to providing tax relief. That way, any sort of property tax or any sort of property loss would result in some sort of relief to that fire victim. Number two, and also this is the process that is also used the following year when we go to adjust the values. This is the percentage we use to adjust the values. Is the loss in real market value. So really this changing it to loss in RMV rather than AV would create consistency and relief across tax years. Number two, recommendation to create similar procedures and timelines depending on whether the property is partially damaged or completely destroyed, be able to treat those the same way, beginning proration the month of damage or destruction, and allow that proration to continue automatically through the end of the tax year. That would allow us as administrators to process all of these at once. If we have identified all the properties that have been affected, this would allow us to go ahead and process all those at once and not have to wait to see if early repair has been made. And the third recommendation is to, in the case of wildfire, where there is, where we are aware of the damage, and I know the legislation that we're talking about further has a provision that there must be a governor declared emergency in order for us to be able to waive that form requirement and go ahead and process those proration and refunds or revised statements automatically without without having to track down the owner and get a signed authorization form from them. So those are the basic concepts behind this legislation. I did further provide some examples on the following pages to really highlight issue number one, because I know that it's a little bit complex, but I'm just going to briefly go over these just to further drive home the point of inconsistency in relief under current law. So currently, in this scenario, property number one, total real market value is $150,000. $50,000 of that is for the house and $100,000 for the land. The maximum assessed value for that property, what that property owner is actually taxed on, is $75,000. So in this scenario, if this property owner lost their home due to fire, that would reduce the value down to land value in this case, assuming the land is the same. So $100,000. However, in that case, the real market value is still above the maximum assessed. So this property owner would see no relief for that tax year. However, if the loss in real market value was what we used as the percentage to prorate the taxes, then you would see a 33%, basically a third reduction in the tax bill for those affected months. And this is kind of a comparison of, okay, under current law, there'd be no relief. Tax bill was $1,500. Tax bill is still $1,500 for that tax year. Under this proposed concept, there'd be a third reduction for those months affected, and the proration would begin the month of damage rather than the month following damage. And so with the calculations involved, that would actually bring down the tax bill to $1,083, roughly knock a third off the tax bill. In property number two, a little bit different scenario for the values. $500,000 real market value on this property, $400,000 for the house. So the house is representing a much larger percentage of the total overall value in this case, $100,000 for the land. So in that case, you lose the house, there would actually be, even under current law, a significant reduction in total taxes, because the assessed value for that property would go from $400,000 down to the land value of $100,000. And so since under current law, the tax relief is dependent on assessed value, there would be some relief there. However, under the proposed legislation, that reduction would go down even further if you're tying it to real market value loss. And I give a kind of a comparison there. Go from $8,000 original tax down to $3,500 under current law. And then if we scroll down farther under the proposed legislation, we get a little bit further reduction if it's tied to RMB down to $2,667. The next is just kind of an overall grid. And now I do want to point out that all we're talking about here is proration of tax. We're not actually adjusting the values until the following tax year, until the following assessment date. And again, this concept would really tie those two together and create consistency in tax relief from the month of damage and subsequent years until any kind of rebuild were to take place. So that's what this table kind of represents. And if you scroll down farther on the next page, I give a couple more examples relating to manufactured structures. Go a little bit farther onto the next page. So two more examples pertaining to manufactured structures. Now, I know Representative Marsh has pointed out that in her county, there were a lot of mobile homes. That's the same in our county for the impacted area. Roughly 80% of our homes that were lost were manufactured structures. And there are a couple different scenarios for those. Sometimes you might have a manufactured structure in a mobile home park. In that case, there would be no land associated with that account. It would strictly be the improvement only. And this first scenario kind of highlights that. We have a real market value for the manufactured home at $40,000. Obviously zero land value. Maximum assessed value for that property is $30,000. And the assessed value is the lower of the two, so $30,000 that they're actually taxed on. Now, there would be relief in this case because obviously the value after fire would go down to zero. So the months that the manufactured structure was in place, in the case of September wildfires, that would have been July and August of 2020. And actually, under current law, since destroyed property isn't prorated until the month after damage, September would have been included too at full tax. So looking at the tax history here, $600 beginning tax bill for this property and $150 ending tax bill. That's at 3 months of full tax. Under the proposed concept, the month of September would actually also be prorated. So that would reduce the tax bill by another $50 there. That's just kind of showing that impact. And then in the final example, the same situation, let's say you have the same manufactured home at $40,000 and it's included with $150,000 of land value. So a total of $190,000 of real market value for this property. The mobile home is destroyed in the fire. Okay, and so we end up with $150,000 of land value. However, the maximum assessed value on that property is $142,000. So the assessed value is not touched in this example under current law, so no tax relief. If you tie the loss in value to real market, the real market after compared to the real market before, and that's the percentage you used to reduce the tax bill, then you can see, if you scroll down a little bit farther, that there is actually relief, 21% reduction in taxes for the month of damage.
Mr. Davidson?
Yeah, sure.
As you know, this is not a public hearing on the bill. We don't, we will have plenty of opportunity to hear the bill and make sure we understand many of the details. I'm watching the clock. We need to conclude this particular item in 5 or 6 minutes. So I just wanted to give you that time check if there's anything to make sure that you wanted to cover as a high-level description of the objectives of this idea. I didn't want to cut you off when you were in the middle of a thought and hadn't gotten to the most important thing, for example.
Oh, yeah, thank you. And that was actually it. So thank you for that. But I was pretty much done at that last example, and I did want to thank you again for your consideration and open it up to any questions. I know I threw a lot of information and numbers at you. I just really wanted to touch on those examples to hit that point home.
That's great. It really helps us envision the challenges and of working in a system that's real technical and a lot of different situations and a lot of constraints. Committee members, do you have questions for Representative Marsh as our having organized the discussion for today, or Mr. Davidson? I don't see any right now. Rep Pham, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question, but I did just want
to... Oh, I can't hear you. Rep Pham, can you
hear me now?
Oh, that's good. Thank you.
Okay, sorry with my audio settings. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to just express my appreciation to all the coalition. It sounds like these tax collectors and county assessors for coming up with this proactive solution. And thank you, Rep. Marsh. I really appreciate the deep thinking that's gone into this, and look forward to hearing more about it and discussing more in future sessions.
Great, thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to express my appreciation for the chance to talk about this. The fact that we had an experience in the state of Oregon that was so, had such a widespread effect really gives us an opportunity to talk about corrections to our arcane property tax law that will benefit people both in this situation, but in future disasters or one-off experiences. And I appreciate the group of stakeholders who have been mulling this over and who will be back to talk to you about more specifics of our proposal.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I answered my question, so thank you.
Nice job.
Yeah.
Great. Representative Marsh, you mentioned an arcane system and some of the changes that could be brought about through our statutory changes could benefit people in future situations, even one-off. So, for example, let's say the winter rains this season bring storms that because of the fire impacted property. This has happened in years in the past. It will happen years in the future. Sometimes there's a landslide, and it may not be massive. It may not be in seven counties around the state, but someone may lose a home due to a landslide, for example, or a major structure that was on their property. This could apply to that situation as well?
Absolutely. The recalculation that we've been considering and will propose when we get to the public hearing stage, again, would apply to the 2020 disaster, but also to anything that happens in the future, because the proration formula is in statute and currently applies in all of those cases. So it's a permanent change to the statute that will affect individual or widespread issues.
Thank you. Other questions or comments on this topic? If not, I'm closing the informational meeting now on property tax response to wildfires. Thank you, Mr. Davidson, and others who were available for this discussion. Mr. Alanak, last words from LRO.
So thank you, Madam Chair. The last note I would like to draw the committee's attention to is in meeting materials. We have added two of our regular reports. We have our basic facts report, which was mentioned during the orientation. It's a thick document, a lot of preliminary high-level information, all the taxes. We ran into some technical issues and weren't able to finish it by the start of session. But that is done, and it's uploaded into the meeting materials. And our tax credit report is also now done, and we've uploaded that to meeting materials, and they will be available on our website by end of day tomorrow.
And I trust the tax credit report that you loaded has fewer pages than the tax expenditures report that was published with over 400 pages.
It has many fewer pages, yes.
Then I'll be sure to read them all. Thank you. Committee, any other comments before I adjourn for the day? Okay, good to see you all. Thanks. We're adjourned.